This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 29th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. On this week's show, we'll be travelling from the breezy streets of San Francisco to the dizzying heights of Tokyo via a Bentwood furniture master, a heritage pen maker, and a creative agency celebrating a big birthday. It's a roller coaster of a show this week, so let's waste no time getting started. Coming up, we scale the heights of the Tokyo Sky Tree, the second tallest man-made structure in the world, which opened last week.
From that dizzying height, individual buildings are hard to make out. And the city's next tallest structure, Tokyo Tower, looks tiny by comparison.
We drop in on the London studio of Pentagram Design Agency to hear how it's doing on its 40th anniversary.
The fact that we can be doing things next after all those 40 years is phenomenal. Somehow, we are more relevant than ever.
And in San Francisco, we sit down with Matt Dick, master apron maker and uniform specialist, clothing the best service men and women in town.
I think more than not, we're inspired by more kind of agrarian peasant society and looking back on history and that than the Western approach to fine tailoring.
All that plus we sit down with Wendy Dagworthy, Dean of Fashion at the RCA, Philip Tonnet, CEO of the eponymous Bentwood and Tubular steel manufacturer, and we visit Aurora, a fourth-generation family-run pen maker in Turin. That's all to come on this week's Section D. Stay tuned. Japan's newest landmark, the Tokyo Sky Tree, opened to the public on May the 22nd, after more than 7 years of construction and planning at a cost of 650 million euros. Rising 634 metres into the sky, the TV and radio broadcast tower is the world's second tallest man-made structure. Its spire can be spotted from almost anywhere along Tokyo's eastern edge. It's already attracting visitors from around Japan and will no doubt be a magnet for tourists from abroad. Whilst the highlight of a visit to the tower is seeing the city from the observation decks, the developer, railway operator Tobu, also built 37,000 square metres of commercial space for shops, restaurants and cafes. Kenji Hall, Monocle's Tokyo correspondent, reports at the Skytree's opening.
The elevator ride almost seems too short. It takes less than a minute to reach the lowest floor on Tokyo Skytree's observatory deck, 340 meters up. And the only sounds are your own ears popping from the altitude and an automated voice announcing your arrival. As you step off the elevator and move toward the tall windows, the city comes into view. From that dizzying height, individual buildings are hard to make out, and the city's next tallest structure, Tokyo Tower, looks tiny by comparison. The Skytree is a giant digital TV and radio broadcasting antenna, but the developer, railway operator Tobu, made sure that the tower wouldn't just be admired from afar. Inside the Skytree, the elevators make 5 stops along the observatory deck. And everything about the space seems designed to get you to sit and take in the view. The staff all wear original uniforms with a triangular tower motif created by fashion designer Akira Minagawa of Japanese label Mina Perhonen. There are cafes, a gift shop, and 2 restaurants serving French cuisine and Japanese teppanyaki, where chefs stand in front of diners and cook meats and vegetables on a flat-top grill. Here's Saya Matsunami, who helped set up the cafes.
The tower's 2 cafes are on floors 340 and 350. The lower floor is a sit-down cafe, and the upper floor has a takeaway counter, so you can have refreshments while you enjoy the view. Both menus feature Japanese desserts and drinks, like 3 types of rich ice cream made with milk from a farm near Mount Fuji, and 3 types of vinegar-flavored drinks.
Officials have lofty estimates for the number of visitors, 32 million in the first year and 25 million every year after that. Each day, no more than 9,000 ticket holders will pay a visit to the observatory floors inside the tower. So it's left to the shopping complex at the base of the tower to draw the biggest crowds. With more than 300 shops, restaurants, and cafes to choose from, along with an aquarium, a planetarium, and an exhibition space, you could spend hours wandering the hallways. And there are plenty of outdoor and indoor public seating areas with great views of the tower. Opening day on May 22nd was miserably rainy and cold, and some retailers were worried after a lower-than-expected visitor turnout. But since then, there has been a crush of visitors. On any given day, so many people crowd into the shopping complex that you end up walking along the hallways in a slow shuffle. And at midday and early evening, long lines form outside the restaurants and cafes. The shops sell souvenirs, sweets, toys, clothing. There's a Zara, Samantha Tavassa, and Starbucks. But it's the made-in-Japan retailers that dominate. One shop sells tenugui, a traditional thin cotton towel. Another sells only handcrafted chopsticks. Hayashiya, a high-end Tokyo fruit vendor that's been around since 1934, has a fruit bar. And Hello Kitty has bags, trinkets, and clothes. Japanese fashion retailer United Arrows, sportswear and shoe brand Onitsuka Tiger, and sock specialist Tabio are present as well. For many of these retailers, it's a rare opportunity to reach customers who might not be familiar with their products or brands. For instance, Stetico.com, which sells cotton knee-length pants that were traditionally worn underneath a kimono. Here's shop manager Emi Tsuda.
Visitors are here from all over Japan and from overseas, so this is an opportunity for us to raise awareness about these pants, which have been around since Japan's medieval period. Plus, we have products that go well with these pants, like sandals and tanuki towels. Most of our stock is actually made in this area.
On a warm, sunny spring day, the best place to unwind is in a large outdoor quadrangle on the fourth floor of the complex. The elevators to the observatory deck inside the tower stop here. With so few tickets to the observatory deck sold, most visitors are content to crane their necks for a view of the tower from below. Some sit at the 100% chocolate cafe run by Japanese confectionery maker Meiji. Here's manager Akiko Matsuyama.
We originally were offered a different plot for our shop, but this is one of the only places you can see the tower, and we felt it would be perfect for relaxing and re-energizing yourself. It's also a great spot to advertise a new way of enjoying Japanese chocolate to visitors. Wonderwall's Masamichi Katayama designed this store, which is our second in Tokyo. Here we sell a white chocolate ice cream and various chocolate drinks. And because we have limited space inside, we wanted a takeout window to sell ice cream, chocolate drinks, and cake that customers could eat in this outdoor plaza.
Before the Skytree went up, you wouldn't have found many tourists in this part of the city. The Sumida Ward neighborhood traditionally has been one of small factories and artisans' workshops. With the tower attracting so much worldwide attention, Skytree officials made a point of providing a space inside the shopping complex for local businesses to showcase what they do. A local dye factory does work for fashion designer Issei Miyake, for instance. And a metalsmith produces the clips for many of Pentel's pens. Tiny workshops churn out everything from wallets and bags to name stamps that people use on official documents here. The Sumida Machidokoro is run by the local ward's tourism bureau, and according to Sumida official Hirotoshi Kaito, it gives small businesses in the area a venue they might not otherwise have.
Sumida's tourism board is using this space to explain to Japan and the rest of the world what the area is known for. On display, we have manufactured goods, crafts, and food. Sumida artisans make leather goods and traditional glassware called Edo Kiriko. Also, Sumida is famous for making tiny metal bearings. We wanted to show the diversity of products made locally. Until now, a lot of people didn't know much about these products, so this space gives us an outlet to display and sell these items.
An international landmark helping out small local businesses. Now that's a concept worth exporting. For Monocle, I'm Kenji Hall in Tokyo.
That was our Tokyo correspondent Kenji Hall at the Skytree last week. Time for a quick break, but stay tuned. We'll be wishing Pentagram a happy birthday after this.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Pentagram is a global design agency with a difference. Founded in London in 1972 by Alan Fletcher, Theo Crosby, Colin Forbes, Kenneth Grange and Mervyn Kurlansky, it has expanded today to 19 partners spread across offices in London, New York, San Francisco, Austin and Berlin. What makes it so unusual is that it is a cooperative, owned by each of its partners. Every partner has their own team and works on their own projects. All staff resources are shared. All revenue is divided equally. This year, Pentagram celebrates its 40th anniversary, and we headed to its West London studio to speak to a handful of partners about how it works. First up, industrial designer Daniel Weil.
Pentagram is like, in a way, like the solar system. Where every planet is independent. But now and again, we take a little bit of the role of the sun because we are very, very independent. So this organization allows the autonomy to have your own gravity, make your own decisions, and then collaborate with others because we belong to the same system. Gives this Pentagram a very unique model. I don't think there is anything like it in design or has ever existed. At the beginning could have been a rock and roll band or something like that, they're still relevant and playing until their late age. But I think with time we have become something else because we've been now many generations of people of aging rock and rollers and young players and new musicians. But somehow I think what it is remarkably right is that the period it started in was absolutely the right period because we are dedicated to a sort of cooperative idea where we are equal owners of the company. Then the original partners realized that they needed to get the next generation in. And with it, they invented other rules to allow people to buy in and find and take their time. And I think Pentagram is about taking your time and not thinking that it is instant. It is a space you're given, a platform you're given, and take your time to demonstrate that you can be a solid partner.
There's no doubt Pentagram, for all of its unusual structure, works, and it works extraordinarily well. The clients they work with are as varied as the skills of the 19 partners, from Mothercare to Walgreens, Nokia to the Savoy, the Guggenheim Foundation to the charity Witness. The London office is a hive of quiet industry, based since 1984 in a 19th century former milk factory. Designer Harry Pierce explains what it feels like to work there.
Every day I walk in here, it has an effect on you. I mean, you absolutely, you know, architecturally, this is so much about the original people that started it. I think they designed the lights and half the furniture and the space. So you're definitely in the spirit of the people that this grew from, even though we, you know, put new work in and make, you know, small changes. It's always the spirit of this timeless spirit of what Pentagram represents. So I think there's a lovely richness and warmth that's in that you feel. I've felt it ever since I've walked in here. So there is a weight that comes with the history, but there's also a liberation that comes with the collective, that you can reinvent yourself. I think Paula Sherwood would probably say she's had several careers within Pentagram while she's been in her time here. And the team around me changes, and the greater team that Pentagram is changes. And you get, Angus made a really interesting point in one of our meetings a while ago, is that you need to, the next person that comes in as a partner, you should feel the challenge of that it makes you reappraise what you're doing and the level of what you're doing. And not to say frightened by it, but you should feel, you know, the little bit of excitement of this new energy. And I think what a fantastic thing that you've got this constantly happening to you, and also the energy of other people. I mean, one of my favorite moments in being in Pentagram is when the whole group are together. It's magical when you have these 3 or 4 days that we spend every 6 months together, and you sit in this room with this diverse group of all, you know, that goes on. Sometimes it's profoundly difficult, and sometimes it's absolutely elevating and exciting. But that energy is unmatchable, and I get such a hit and a high from that group when you're gathered. So there's that other learning. There's that other learning from the others.
The latest partner to join was Naresh Ramchandani. He is the first advertising and communications partner to join Pentagram. A daunting prospect, presumably. Not just to be the new boy in such an esteemed crowd, but also one with skills plotting new territory for the firm.
I joined because I think it was a nice way of taking my thinking forward. Equally, I think hopefully the idea is whenever a Pentagram partner joins, they bring something in to Pentagram as well. And that also was an exciting opportunity for me because my background is in communication. I've worked at 3 advertising agencies and I'm a copywriter. I can't draw like the other partners. So what I'm able to do is work with them and add a little bit of what I've got, which is a way of making brands communicate and making them talk and making them move and making them actually get to consumers in a way that is perhaps adding something to what they've already got. Pentagram is an idea, but it's very much an evolving idea. And really its sort of truest way of evolving is by the partners who come in, because that's really a big part, you know, a very large part of what it is as a culture. I mean, Pentagram needs to stay relevant and wants to stay relevant and wants to expand its sense of what it does. I think so long as everyone has the same values, which is to do with doing a job very properly, doing it very commercially, but also very creatively, and believing that the level of the creativity is a big part in terms of how commercially effective it is. I think as long as it's from within that set of values and a belief system about how to behave with the organisations you do work for, which is properly, I think different skills being represented is a great thing. Is a great thing. And so I'm a slightly new skill. Hopefully there'll be others to follow.
And it's this organic growth of people and skills that keeps Pentagram at the top of its game. Creative agencies have a habit of falling in and out of fashion, getting stuck, churning out the same work that got them business in the first place, afraid to evolve with the times or push boundaries. This is not the score on Pentagram's script.
Well, I think living in that spirit of liberation has got to be a key. It may get much wider than the kind of disciplines that are in it. And as you can, as the world's changing and culture's shifting, I think Pentagram will just naturally shift with what's going on in the greater world, because people, you know, the diverse cultural backgrounds of the partners, I mean, it's hugely diverse. And I think that will just self-generate and change in line with the way the world changes. It's one of the lucky things that Pentagram is. Otherwise, it's nothing. It will recede if it doesn't carry on broadening, I think.
I think it's just got to be curious. It can't be complacent, it's got to be curious. I mean, Pentagram's done amazing things in the past. That's not enough. You know, you have to just keep on going, and you have to know what you're about and stay true to that, and also know that you need to evolve that, otherwise you're an old model. And I think that's really, really important for Pentagram to do that, you know, to find different partners who bring in different skills. As well as new partners in those fields that Pentagram's well known for, that bring sort of new energy to that. But I think it needs to be an evolving model. That's the key.
The fact that we can be doing things next after all those 40 years is phenomenal. And we are somehow, we are more relevant than ever in the sense that we have not deviated from wanting to address the authenticity of design. There's a belief that designers, as generalist practitioners, can actually, and creative practitioners, because having extended our family to the full creative gamut, having somebody from advertising and a creative director in advertising, we are demonstrating that somehow protecting the idea of the discipline of designing is more important than just kneeling down to the commerce of it. Others have done it with different models of ownership and different intentions. Our intention is to practice design well, do great design, and earn a very good living.
And maybe the secret to their success is as simple as that. Happy birthday, Pentagram. Here's to another 40 years. And in the celebratory mood we stay, here's Stevie Wonder serenading Pentagram with Happy Birthday. That was Stevie Wonder with Happy Birthday. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. It's graduation time around the world, and having been carefully incubated, eager students are now emerging into the real world to turn their creativity into a profession. On Section D, over the next few months, we'll be talking to the directors of architecture, fashion and design schools about their classes of 2012. First up, it's Wendy Dagworthy, Dean of the School of Fashion, Menswear and Womenswear at the Royal College of Art in London. The RCA is undisputably one of the world's leading fashion schools. Past alumni include Christopher Bailey, Neil Barrett, Ozzy Clark, Philip Tracy and Erdem. Monocle's Gillian DeBias sat down with Wendy Dagworthy to hear about the RCA approach.
The Royal College of Art MA graduation shows are known for one of the best places to spot rising stars and new talent. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the philosophy behind the teaching that keeps producing such amazing designers.
I think what we do is really encourage students to be themselves, love and enjoy what they do, push what's going on in fashion, challenge ideas, and really research whatever they research, on a personal basis. So they've really got to love and have a passion for what they do.
When you're looking through portfolios, does risk play a factor? Are you looking for risk takers? What are you looking for in the students?
We're looking for, risk takers, definitely. Passion about the subject. And someone that really does their own thing. But, I mean, it's their attitude as well. It's not just looking at the portfolio. It's interviewing that person and really, sort of making sure they just want to do what they really want to do.
I understand your department is called School of Materials, which is slightly unusual. Why the emphasis on materials?
Well, it's the School of Material. And all the programmes within the school. So we have fashion, textiles, ceramics and glass, goldsmithing, silversmithing, metalwork and jewellery. And we all work with materials. So it's that sort of emphasis on the material, how we use it, and using different materials as well. And we encourage them, within the school, but also within the college, to actually really move into different departments and use different materials. Say for a milliner is using perspex. It's not just felt or straw. So we really push that use and different use of material.
There's so much technology available to students, but do you find their sensibilities, there's a return to craft?
Definitely. And actually this year as well, there's definitely a return to the sort of craft element of things. We have a lot of tailoring, embroidery, beadwork. So there's a lot of that coming through as well.
There is incredible raw talent amongst your students. Are you finding, it's not like an art school, a pure art school. In fashion, they have to be very disciplined about the business. Are you finding this is shifting and they are more attuned to the business side, or is that a difficult mix?
It is a very difficult mix, yes. And not every designer has that business acumen. And I mean, you can instill some of it in them, but if it's not there, it's not there. And what we encourage is business students, we have links with Imperial College, they're business students. We try and encourage that link with them as well. So we often say, if you are setting up, try and get a business partner, because it's so much easier if you have. Obviously, it's easier said than done because you have to trust that person implicitly. But I think, yeah, that's often the best way forward.
Talk to us a little bit about the class of 2012. What is the fashion of the students saying about them, the times they're designing in?
I think, funnily enough, it's really optimistic. I think the collections are full of optimism. They're exciting, they're colourful, they're full of print. Hardly any black collections, a few here and there, but there's colour coming through, and I think that's a great thing, that they are optimistic in, you know, this sort of economic climate as well.
When you see each class, it's kind of a bit of a barometer, possibly. And so I was wondering if you sense, are students at all looking at clothes as agents provocateurs, as agents of change? Are they at all politically astute in their designs?
Not all of them, but yes, quite a few are. Yes, they're looking at what's happening in the world, sustainability. So we encourage that as well. And, you know, some of them do make comments on what is going on, definitely, yes. But it's a balance. I mean, that's what we try and do. We get a balance of different types of student, I suppose. Some that do want to go out in the world and do their own thing. Others that actually do want to go into bigger companies and be part of a bigger team.
That was our own Gillian DeBias with Wendy Dagworthy, Dean of Fashion at the RCA. And sticking with a fashion theme, we're off to San Francisco now. Matt Dick runs a studio on Park Street, from which he makes the most beautiful aprons. A niche skill, you might think, but one with considerable appeal in the city and the Bay Area, with the number of restaurants, hotels and cafes there. Not just limited to aprons, Dick designs utility and service wear for a range of businesses too. I dropped by to find out more.
I am a designer, I guess, by trade. I make things for a living. Right now, as I just told you, I have a foot on both sides of the fence in uniform coordination, design and production, and also building slowly a small product company of both clothing, apparel, and we like bags a lot, so I'm just going to say we have a small bag collection in the making. Pretty inspired by the way people go to work around the world. We like our layers and lengths, and I think more than not we're inspired by more kind of agrarian peasant society and looking back on history and that than kind of the Western approach to fine tailoring. Although we like to get ourselves in that whenever we can.
So it's sort of fine tailoring meets workwear meets sort of the way people dress to do sort of dirty work or service work, do you think?
Yeah, I think more definitely dirt involved. I mean, we're very much always inspired by agrarian peasants and fishermen. A lot of tunics and caftans and full cut pants, padded vests and jackets. It's definitely country living when you're out in the elements. I also have a background steeped in Japan, so that's definitely part of my wrapping approach to people's bodies. I think we cut a lot less than most studios. We're really much about kind of how little can we change this roll of fabric before we can put it on a body to make it clothing.
So how does that work? Do you sort of involved in dyeing and things as well then?
Yeah, we are not directly, although that might change this year. We have always worked with the people who are more of the experts in dyeing. I work with dyers north of Tokyo, Indigo Dyers in Saitama, and we also work with a woman who regularly works with weavers of khadi cotton in Kolkata, India. And I actually have a husband and wife team that goes often to China, to Guizhou, and they find many beautiful relics of jewelry and furniture and come back. They have a gallery here, but they also bring me back small rolls of textiles, which I appreciate very much. A lot of the beautiful pounded indigos that you find in those mountainous regions from the Hmong and Dong people, and hand-loomed, both natural bast fibers and totally undyed, and also the more rarefied kind of lacquered-looking pounded indigos and some stripes once in a while to mix things up.
So it's a bit of a cultural melting pot. How did you get into this quite particular niche industry?
It just happened naturally, really. The uniform thing, which kind of came as default by one hotel project. I agreed to dress the staff of a LEED certified luxury hotel in the Napa Valley. And I thought by the end of that project I would never do it again. I was cursing that whole idea of fitting so many bodies without really having the budget, you know, to do what you could do. But of course, from that job, and I did the hotel shop concept, and that was really fun. Retail and concept about around retail and buying and just getting your friends involved is always a lot of fun. But the uniform challenge is fun in the end when you see how happy people are, but it's a lot of work. And that job launched two more. I met James Freeman of Blue Bottle Coffee Company on that job, and Thad Vogler of Bar Agricole. And so those two came next. And then there's a lot of private events and parties with Stanley Gowdy, who's a local event planner, celebrity event planner, I guess you could say, who's been very supportive of our workshop. And now we, you know, just kind of grown through word of mouth and by referral, which I like a lot because I don't have to go out and sell our brand of creativity. I feel like people come kind of knowing what they're going to get, which is nice because we can start the conversation there and everyone's excited. And you know, things so far, knock on glass and steel, go pretty smoothly.
You mentioned that dressing people for work or uniforms is very difficult. Why is it more difficult to do that than just to dress them for everyday life?
Well, I think when you're dealing with a project like a hotel or even a restaurant, no one knows exactly who the cast of characters is going to be while you're doing your job. So we're figuring out a uniform, but we don't really know yet who all these bodies are. So you have to come up with something that's going to work and just give some leeway, you know, give a little bit of flexibility where, with regards to fit. And then, of course, you know, it is workwear, so you have to consider laundering and wear. And nobody wants to wear 100% polyester boxy shirt and look like you're wearing your big brother's clothes, or you've somehow, like, you know,
it smelled like it.
Wrapped your pants around yourself twice. It just, I hadn't really looked into the options for business owners, especially in the restaurant industry. It's pretty bleak. So I feel like we really grasped on to this idea of doing the uniform business because I would want that option if I was, you know, going to open a restaurant.
The sort of local food movement really was born in this area, and people sort of take it very seriously about provenance and where things come from. Do you think that the sort of uniform element in restaurants, coffee bars, all these places as well, that you outfit, sort of like having the Made in San Francisco extend to the clothes that the staff wear as well?
I think so, just by nature of us trying to make the best option happen within a deadline. We don't try to get too far-reaching around the world with shipping things everywhere, although some great stuff comes from far away. So I never really thought of us as like a Made in San Francisco operation, although I think we are. And actually, one of the newest coordinations we're going to do is for the Shorenstein Group. It looks like we're going to be dressing the ushers and ticket takers for the staff that works for the company that brings in all the Broadway plays to San Francisco. And because all of those theaters happen to be in the Tenderloin, I didn't know this, but the reason I think our office really appealed to the owner of this company is because we were also in the Tenderloin. So now it's not only become San Francisco, but we've cut it down to like a neighborhood.
Made in the Tenderloin.
Yeah, Made in the Tenderloin.
Sounds a bit rude.
Well, it can be, believe me. There's never a dull moment around here, but I think we like it like that somehow.
Matt, thank you very much. That was me with Matt Dick in his San Francisco studio last week. Time for another short break, but do stay tuned. We're off to Turin to talk pens after this.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and, again, how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Section D. Now, in past episodes of the show, our focus on Italy has been directed towards the country's formidable furniture-making brands. But Italy has plenty of manufacturing might up its sleeve in other sectors. Or should we say, tucked away in shirt and suit pockets. Aurora is a family-run firm that for four generations has made fountain pens, using hand craftsmanship and a healthy dose of Italian creativity. Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho visited the company's factory in Turin to speak with owner Cesare Verona.
Hello, I'm Cesare Verona. I'm the proud owner of Aurora Pens. I'm representing the fourth generation, as my family has been involved in the history of writing since nearly 160 years.
Now, a lot of Italian companies have decided to move some of their production overseas. I notice that here, everything is made in Italy.
Well, yes, this is something that we are proud of, number one. And it's also a philosophy of the company and is basically a strategic decision I have taken. I think it has been a very difficult decision in the 90s and 2000s when all the people were moving and going either Eastern countries or to China and something. I have the strong belief that we have to go back to things that should be manufactured, and I hope and think that Aurora can give the feeling and the flavor of European countries that can do upscale market with creation and the capability of doing craftsmanship. So basically we have been trying to match the idea and the concept of a product with the manufacturing in Italy, where we have a lot of experience, a lot of culture to link with the capability of doing things with hands. I think this is something unique to Italy and to France, I would say. And so I felt that it was a big challenge, but I felt that we could work and try to, let's say, overcome that challenge. And this is the reason why I'm keeping the production here in Torino, in Italy, and we are absolutely doing 100% of a pen, which is looking to be a very easy product, but it's not at all. And maybe I will be able to make your listener discover the history of a pen and how a pen can be created by the sound of my voice, even if they cannot see what I am going to talk about.
Most people think about pens and they just think four or five little pieces. I see here you've got many machines, lots of handwork. Just explain what goes into making one of these pens.
Well, to make a pen is usually much more complicated than what people would think. And I want to, just to take some few examples, and by telling that inside an Aurora pen of, let's say, a good level of quality, you might find more than 200 different operations. And you can find and you can start from the very, very heart, which is the nib. Then we are the only Italian manufacturer of nibs, and we are one of the very few companies in the world that are still doing nibs. Then another part is the very body, the barrel, where you keep the ink, because you have to store the ink somewhere. And just you have a combination of injection molding, you have a combination of turning machine, which means that you work on that, and then you have a piston filler, which means a very complicated way of sucking the ink and creating a vacuum where you can hold the ink and you can write. We were discussing about having the feeling of a pen, having the pen in your hands. Well, you have a lot of people creating both with machine and with handmade operation this beautiful object that I would say it's a jewel. And this jewel, at the very end of the steps, will be taken into careful hands of a lady, and she will try to see if the writing is smooth and just adjust eventually some of the little details to make an Aurora pen a jewel and and something to be treasured for time.
So how important is design for your company?
I think that design is very important to Aurora, and it's really connected with the history of the company. Since the very, very beginning, from the 20s and then moving up to the 40s, we have been involved with designers. So a big Italian guy called Marcello Nizzoli, which is one of the designers that have created Lettera 22, a special typewriter, of with Abe Steiner, Marco Zanuso, who have led us some of the products together and to be exposed at the Museum of Modern Art. We are very much involved because the pen, first of all, has to be in a hand and it has to write. You have to use it. I mean, it's not just a functional object, it's that you're touching the five senses. So you can see by your eyes, you can touch and feel it with your hands when you have a gripping section that is helping you, you need to have a good balance. You probably are pleased by your eyes when you have an aesthetical feeling of the product and the material that you're touching. You can be, it can be hot, it can be cold as a metal, and it has to work properly on a paper. So I think that design is playing an important role on a pen, and for Aurora, once again, we are Italian. I think Italians have a specific feeling with something created to and linked to design. I think it's quite important, and it's one of the value of Aurora products and Aurora pens.
That was Cesare Verona of Aurora Pen Makers with our Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, in Turin. Sticking with the family manufacturing theme, I sat down with Philip Tonnet, one of three brothers in charge of the fifth-generation German family-run furniture manufacturer Tonnet. If you don't know Tonnet by name, you'll definitely know it by sight. The company is one of the oldest manufacturers in Europe, the inventor of the bent wood technique, and the proponent of bent tubular steel furniture too. Philip joined me in Studio 2 to talk me through the highs and lows of such a historic business.
Well, we run the company as three brothers in the fifth generation, descendant from Michael Tonnet, direct descendants. And myself, I'm responsible for international markets and new markets, basically. And I'm here because I love London, I have to admit that. And I always enjoy being here.
And, I mean, Tonnet is perhaps maybe the most famous chair company in the world. It's not an exaggeration to say that your ancestor who founded the company sort of revolutionized the way that chairs were made with this bent wood technique. And, I mean, was this the first sort of industrial production of chairs?
I think, besides porcelain, this was the first industrial production of a product in general. I can't think of anything that was produced in an industrial way besides porcelain. If you consider the Model T, which was 100 years later with the first serial production, at least it was the first serial production of a chair and probably of a product.
These chairs are everywhere in the world to see now. What is the sort of responsibility that you feel as one of the family who still owns the company?
Well, I feel responsible to continue the history of the company in the family possession, and I feel certainly responsible for what we do now and how the products are being made nowadays and towards our clients. Because when you create a product and you sell it, you have a certain responsibility towards the people who buy it regarding long-lastingness, regarding function, all different matters.
Are the chairs made in a different way today from how they were when the company was founded?
When you talk about the bentwood products, this has nothing changed because you need the close control over the product over the made of the product. The bentwood, the rods before they've been bent, they varied very much in quality and in consistency because the stem, each stem is different, but also within the stem, the further you go inside the stem or outside, close to the rim of the stem, the wood is totally different and reacts different to bending. So you need this certain feeling in your hands when bending it to more let loose or to give more pressure. This is nothing a machine can do. So it is all manual work, still the same as 150 years ago.
And you're bringing the machine that you used to bend the wood to London later in the year.
In September to Design Junction event, yes, we are.
Is this a way of trying to sort of open up the process to show people why it's so revolutionary and how it works and to connect people to the end product?
This is one approach. I think today nobody knows how products are being made. People think something is getting into the factory and the ready product is getting out. I think it's so important to make people aware that there's so many steps in the process of making a product. And this is what the bending machine is supposed to do for, just to make people aware of how things are being produced, at least this chair.
And what's the reaction of people when they see what goes on?
Very surprised, very enthusiastic and very astonished about what is going on, what you can do with wood. and we leave some bended pieces for the people. We ask people to bend, and it's really something very sensational.
You're the fifth generation in charge of the Tonic Company. How do you keep this company relevant? What's one thing to sort of go back and tell the story of production and things, but do you sort of look to push new boundaries with new methods of production and to bring in sort of younger name designers as well to sort of shake things up a bit?
Funny you mentioned that, because we've always done that. We've always had more than 50% of our products were, besides the Bauhaus and the Bentwood, were always contemporary furniture. We've always worked with young designers and designers from who create products for our needs, for our fields of application, which is conferencing, mass seating, lounges, and furniture for restaurants. And the awareness is always on the Bentwood. The Bentwood and the history is always overshadowing the products of today, which we feel is a pity, because I feel we still do pretty products and nice products and helpful products.
Maybe 150 years from now, people will be looking at the products that you created today.
Probably, I hope so. We're working on that.
Yeah. And do you, with a family-run company, is it difficult to make sure that things, or that you keep your factory work here, or do you think it's easier as part of the original founding family of Tonnet to make decisions that you're going to produce here and not outsource everything to China just to keep costs down?
I think when you run the business as a family, as an owner, you feel more responsibility towards the people who work with you and about the quality of the product, and this helps making the decision to stay in your location, to stay in the country. Although it seems tempting to go and produce somewhere else at very low cost, and maybe sell at the same price level and make money.
But you're killing the soul of the company by doing that.
Yes, it kills the whole company, the whole sense of the company, and this whole sense of the story of the company too.
And your factory is based just north of Frankfurt.
It's north of Frankfurt, about an hour and a half north of Frankfurt.
Do you feel that it has a wider sort of role in the local community there, where there are families who've worked there for generations and things?
Definitely for generations. You're right. We have people in the company who worked as in fourth or fifth generation. Some are really come over from Czechoslovakia, from the old factories, because the old factories were in Czechoslovakia and now Poland. And Frankenburg is only 120-something years old, where the old factories are much older.
Is there a next generation who can continue this?
There is. Sons of my brothers and myself.
That's good to know. Are they being trained as apprentices there already?
No. They have to make their own decision what to do. So it's a very delicate process to make them aware what the company is about.
Whilst not pushing them into
it. No, definitely. You would just reach the opposite.
But for you and your brothers, was there any other question that you might do something other than work for the company?
I think more for myself, because I went to the States, did something else, and I have strong interest in photography. So for me, it was a decision to make.
That was Philipp Tonnet of the eponymous German manufacturer in Studio 2 with me earlier. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Today's show was produced by Gillian DeBias and edited by James Bacon. Next week, we'll be touring the stands of the Mid-Century Modern Furniture Show in London, talking Swedish appliances with Electrolux in Stockholm, and visiting Auckland's premier fashion designer, Doris Dupont, to hear about her favourite things. Be sure to tune in then. For now, playing you out, here's Kool and the Gang with Celebration. Thank you for listening.